In Daniel chapter 11, there are over 135 specific prophecies. Daniel is writing about 500 or so BC. To him, it'll be future events. To us, we're looking back in the past. From Malachi to Matthew is about 400 years. And so many have termed those 400 years as the 400 silent years. It turns out that Daniel chapter 11 is going to tell us what's going to happen during those 400 years. There is so much here, you guys. If we were to run every one of them down in the history books or show Wikipedia up there on the wall, you'd get a little itchy and antsy. And I'm going to throw lots and lots and lots of history your way. I hope you don't mind that the Lord said, I want you to love me with all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength. This will almost be an exercise in tedium. It's the bane of modern society. Don't let me get bored for a minute, you know, so I pull out my phone or whatever. Probably we'll get around verse number 21 or 22. I love to tell the story of a dear friend of mine many, many years ago before I moved here to Reno. I lived in Redding, as many of you know. Carol Voorhees at the time, she was a precious sister. She was a part of our young adults group at the time. And she came into our Saturday night time with a big grin on her face. And everybody's going, well, what's going on, Carol? What? She goes, you wouldn't believe what just happened. What? We said. Well, I got to tell you, I've been a little bummed and a little sort of disappointed. Some things in my life didn't go the way I expected. And so I was bumming, and I was bumming at the Lord. And I said, Lord, you know what I need? I just need something concrete to know that you're there. I'm sure none of you in this room have ever been there. She's driving, tears on her face. She said, Lord, I've been serving you a long time. At the time, she was probably 19, you know. All my life, you know, all these years. And Lord, I hope it's not too much to ask. I don't want to be presumptuous as she's driving. But Lord, can you show me an angel? Please. I don't think it's too much to ask. I won't freak out and I won't write a book, you know. I just want to see an angel. Please, I'd love to see an angel, Lord God. And she sort of opened her eyes a little bit and then looked up and she came to a stop. And she had stopped right behind a van. Angel's maid service. And on the back of the closed double doors of the service van were painted two. She goes, all right, Lord. True story. I know you guys love the Lord, and you wouldn't be here on a Wednesday night if you didn't have a great devotion to Him and His Word. But still, the enemy does what he does, and there are times when the enemy gets some traction. You don't really trust that Bible. You don't really trust that Lord, do you? Well, tonight I want to let you know something. That Daniel's prophecies are so precise. In just the first 20-some verses, I'm going to probably show you 10 to 12 fulfilled Bible prophecies. And it was so precise that the historian said, no way, it had to have been written after the fact. Someone recounting what had already happened. No way that specificity could be talked about in a future sense until they found the Dead Sea Scrolls and come to find out, oh yeah, the book of Daniel is in the Dead Sea Scrolls as well. And when the Essenes had it, when the Romans came sweeping in a little after 70 AD, they'd taken Jerusalem and were on their way to Masada to the south because 900 Jews had escaped their grasp. There was the kind of a monastic Jewish settlement in this area. They were called Essenes by the Dead Sea. And here come the Romans. What do we do? What do we do? Well, they had an extensive library. And they had copies of Old Testament books that for them were hundreds of years old. To us, they'd be over what? They'd be over 2,000 years old. And in the Dead Sea Scrolls that they hid in those caves in an area called Qumran, and there they sat lost for the next 2,000 years until the 1940s when they were discovered, the first of them. And there were several caves that were excavated, and even as soon as just a few months ago, they found even more. One of them was they unsealed the Isaiah scroll intact. And guess what else was in there, you guys? The book of Daniel, chapter 11. And it predates the events we're going to look at now. Let's check it out. Daniel chapter 11, verse 1. And also in the first year of Darius the Mede, this is very likely another name for King Cyrus. We'll run into some other Dariuses later, but it would seem that this Persian king, that the name Darius was a pretty handy name that later people would take. But Darius at this point doesn't seem to be in the history books. And so I think what's happening here is this is one of those names that Cyrus was known by in this region. Cyrus the Great or Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. This is the angel speaking that we were introduced to in chapter 10. Verse 2, and now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise. So who's the king now? That's King Cyrus. Well, he dies, and then his son Cambyses comes to the forefront, 529 B.C. to about 522 B.C. And then after him, a fellow by the name of Smerdes, number 2. And then we have Darius the First, surname Hystapes. Why is that important? Because then he has a son, Xerxes the First. That's the guy we have to perk up and listen to. So for Daniel, Cyrus, and then three more, but the last guy, check him out. Verse 2, I will tell you the truth, three more kings will arise in Persia. I just read them to you. And the fourth shall be far richer from them all. That number 4 is Xerxes the First. And by his strength through his riches, he will stir up all against the realm of Greece. Xerxes, he's quite a general, and he's quite a reformer, and he was a brilliant fellow. The Black Sea drains into this little pinch of land called the Bosporus Straits, where Istanbul is today, and then it kind of moves around this little narrow piece of water. At its narrowest, it's about 2,300 feet across. It's not very wide. And then it moves into a place called the Dardanelles. And then from the Dardanelles, it flows into the Aegean Sea, where Greece is, the Balkan Peninsula, and then ultimately into the Mediterranean. And tides and so on, the river of water rushes into the Black Sea, and you can't really cross the Dardanelles, or when the tide reverses and the water moves rapidly through that narrow area. And so what Xerxes wants to do is he wants to take his group that's there in the Anatolian Peninsula where Turkey is, and he wants to invade the Greeks. But that Dardanelle thing, that's a rough one. So he hatches upon a great idea, and he builds a bunch of barges, and he puts the barges in the Dardanelle and the flow, and then he anchored them securely, and then rowed planks across. And before he launched that little mechanism of war, he had been preparing the 4 years in front, and he had raised an army of almost 1 million soldiers. So here we go. He is going to cross the Dardanelles, but the Greeks knew it as the Hellespont. And he builds his barges, they go on across, and 1 million foot soldiers traffic across this makeshift bridge, and they pour into Greece. And Greece, of course, was a pretty advanced society, and you remember Athens and Sparta and what have you. Well, they run up against a Greek contingent of 7,000 Greek soldiers, but because the odds are overwhelmingly in favor of Xerxes, they have to retreat back towards Greece, and leaving behind, they needed to have a group of people to stand firm in this area called Thermopylae. And 300 Spartans hold off almost 1 million screaming Persians for just enough time that much of their fellow comrades are able to escape Thermopylae. And it's called the Battle of Thermopylae. And you might remember it better from the number of movies that have been made. The most recent was 300, with all the rippling abs. You know, I showed up for that casting call, and they didn't want me for some reason. I don't know why. But eventually, Xerxes, he kills every one of those 300 Spartans to a man. And he chases down and ruthlessly torments, tortures, and kills 7,000 Greek soldiers. It was awful, absolutely awful. And in fact, the Greeks never forgot about that. They sort of viewed the Battle of Thermopylae as we kind of look back at the Alamo. Remember the Alamo? And at one time that fanned a great passion, a flame of great passion in America. Well, Thermopylae stuck in the craw of the Greeks, especially a fellow by the name of Philip of Macedon about 100 years later. And Philip of Macedon was a pretty handy military leader himself. And he had a son, Alexander the Great. And Alexander grew up on the stories of Thermopylae and the brutality with which Xerxes handled his people. And he never forgot about that. By the way, Xerxes' son is a fellow by the name of Mitochire. And we know him more as Longimanus. Mitochire is his real name. Longimanus, it would seem, was a description. Longimanus means long hand. And it's Artaxerxes Longimanus is the one that we read about, of course, in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah. But back to our study. So anyway, there is Xerxes, and he runs roughshod over the Greeks. And the Greeks never forgot about that. And about 120 years after Artaxerxes I, that's when Alexander the Great, he says, I remember that whole crossing of the Hellespont, the Dardanelles. I'm going to do a little crossing of my own. He too puts together a pontoon bridge, and across come the Greeks. Not a million of them, though, but they were lightning fast. And in 334 B.C., he began the reverse assault against the Persian Empire and finally secures the entire Anatolian Peninsula, where Turkey is today, and Asia Minor, after a battle called the Battle of Issus, the spring of 333 B.C. What do we have to do with all that? Now back to chapter 11. Now let's look at verse 3. When a mighty king shall arise, I just told you who that was, Alexander the Great. He will rule with a great dominion and do according to his will, which is exactly what happened. That's about 200-ish years in the future relative to where Daniel is. To us looking back on it, man, here's Daniel sort of just reading tomorrow's newspaper. Verse 4. And when he, Alexander, has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided to the four winds of heaven. A month before his 33rd birthday, living now in the conquered city of Babylon, Alexander the Great, he just drinks himself silly a series of nights. And it is said that either he developed tremendous pneumonia or perhaps he was poisoned. But a month shy of his 33rd birthday, he died. And such a large and extensive empire, larger than the Babylonian Empire, larger than the Medo-Persian Empire, who will the empire go to? Well, let's go to his two sons. Well, one of his sons was born posthumously after he had died and then was murdered. And then he had another son, not of legitimate sort of means or kind of a kingly line, but that son was murdered as well. Now what are we going to do? History tells us it went to his four generals, Ptolemaeus, Seleucus, Cassander, and Lysimachus. Look what Daniel says. Verse 4 one more time. Now when he, we know as Alexander, has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided into four winds of heaven. That's exactly what happened about 120 years later. But not among his posterity. Those four fragments of the one-time great kingdom, none of them will be ruled over by his son, prophesied by Daniel. Hey, is that what happened? That's exactly what happened. Nor according to his dominion with which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be uprooted, even for others besides these. Daniel prophesies that Alexander the Great's empire will break into four pieces. It's exactly what happened. And none of them would be his offspring, but those four generals. And then those four generals became four regions. And then the region of Lysimachus and the region of Cassander, they get overrun by the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. The Ptolemies settle in the south, or what we would know as Egypt. And the Seleucids in Asia Minor and the Anatolian Peninsula. So great kingdom of Seleucids in the north relative to Israel, and in the south relative to Israel in Egypt. And then for the next 400 years, these guys are duking it out one after the other. You'll have to forgive me, but it helps me remember. We got the guys in the south, those are the Ptolemy boys. And you can insert your banjo music there if you'd like. And then the kings of the north, that's going to be the Seleucid boys, namely the lineage of Antiochus, so the Antiochus boys. Verse 5, and so the king of the south, the Ptolemy boys in Egypt, shall become strong as they did, as well as one of his princes. He shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion will be a great dominion. And at the end of some years, they shall join forces. So the boys in the north, the Ptolemy boys, and the boys in the south, they're going to try their first treaty, which does happen. And here's how they're going to pull it off. For the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north, the Antiochus boys, to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the power of her authority. So it's a pretty common practice. Marry the daughter of one kingdom to the son of the other kingdom, and hopefully it will become one big family. So they start, but it's not going to work out, says Daniel. And neither he nor his authority shall stand. It won't work out well. But she, this daughter, shall be given up with those who brought her, and with him, this prince, who shall begot her, and with him who strengthened her in those times. What? If you're keeping score, Ptolemaeus II, remember he's in the south, he has a daughter named Berenice, and he's the one who proposes the marriage to Antiochus II. A.K.A. Antiochus Theus, but he's in the north. Seems like a good plan, except for Antiochus there in the north is already married. Yeah, problem there. And he's married to a gal by the name of Laodice, or Laodice. That should ring a bell, because in that region there's going to be a city named after her. The city of Laodicea, named after her. Well, anyway, so she's married to Antiochus II, and Antiochus II says, well, you know what? I like this Berenice. She's kind of a looker. So he divorces Laodice and marries Berenice in 252 B.C., just like Daniel said. But what did Daniel also say? It's not going to last. Why? Well, let's look at outside history. 5 years later, Berenice's father, Ptolemaeus II, he dies. So then Seleucus II, he says, now that your dad is gone, Berenice, you know, I sort of like Laodice. I'm going to marry her again. So he does. Well, Laodice waits one night until the man, Seleucus II, he's asleep, and she stabs him in the back and kills him. Antiochus II, pardon me. And then murders Berenice and their infant son, who would have been the heir to the throne. Now guess who's in control of that region? The northern Antiochus boys. Laodice herself. Well, she puts her son with Antiochus II on the throne. And while all this is happening, let's see what's happening down south to the Ptolemy boys. Verse number 7. But from the branch of her, Berenice, remember, she's a Seleucid, from the Antiochus boys, roots one shall arise in his place, who shall come with an army, enter the fortress of the king of the north, the Seleucid guys, and deal with them and prevail. By this time, Ptolemy III, down south, Berenice's brother, He's pretty mad that his sister up north got murdered by Laodice. And what does he do? He mounts an army and goes and thrashes the kingdom, just like Daniel says. He launches an attack against the Antiochus boys, defeats them, and historian Jerome says that when he was leaving, Ptolemy III carries off with him 40,000 talents of silver. That's 400,000 pounds of silver and 200 tons of gold. Worked out pretty well for him. Verse number 8, the soap opera continues. And he, Ptolemy III, southern fella, shall also carry there, the northern boys, gods captive to Egypt, with their princes and their precious articles and silver and gold. And Jerome documents that along with all that silver and gold, 40,000 religious relics were taken from the north back to Egypt. Just like Daniel said. And he, Ptolemy III, the southern fella, shall continue more years than the king of the north. Why would he even put that in there? You look in the history, and Ptolemy III outlived his northern counterpart by 6 years. Interesting little detail. Verse 9, also the king of the north, another Seleucid king, shall come to the kingdom of the south, and he shall return to his own land. In other words, he's not going to make it. It's not going to work out, so he's defeated. Verse 10, however, his sons, more Antiochus boys, shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of great forces. And one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through. Then he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife. Remember Laodice and the son that she put on the throne? He has two sons. One of them will die in battle, and the other is a fellow by the name of Antiochus III or Antiochus the Great. If you look for the word Antiochus, you'll usually see him first. Antiochus III was a consummate military leader, a social reformer, and a master builder. What's important about Antiochus III is he's going to throw his weight around in the region, but he's going to have a son. And his son, Antiochus IV, is the one that invades Israel and kills all the priests, sacrifices a pig on the altar, and puts a Greek god in the Holy of Holies. And that will forever live within the fabric of the Jews' history as one of the most awful times ever. It's called the Abomination of Desolation. That's done by Antiochus IV. Well, let's look at his dad, Antiochus III. Antiochus III attacks Ptolemaeus number 4. Jerome says that Antiochus loses that battle, barely escapes with his life, and loses men and wealth. So Antiochus the Great didn't start off so great. But instead of moping around, he spends the next several years regaining strength, wealth, and soldiers.